All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta.
Well, good afternoon. This is American Vindicta. I'm your host, Doug Thornton. And today, we are going to be talking about the Wunderwaffen, the wonder weapons of the Nazi Empire. Now, I have a lot to get into. I have 15 pages worth of material to talk about in like 50 minutes, so we'll see how much I can get through. But let me just start by saying that I'm not even really scraping the surface of experimental weaponry that the Nazi Empire used, created, and fielded. There's a lot of prototypes out there that I'm not even covering. A lot of the things that I'm covering is either going to be prototypes that were just extraordinary, or prototypes that actually went into the field and saw some element of combat use. Now, most of these weapons, like I said, are prototypes. They never saw combat, or they were in the field, but there is a litany of historians out there who will tell you that had some of these weapons been introduced, it could have actually changed the tide of the war. And had Germany better prepared themselves for a military confrontation instead of this worldwide Nazistic view takeover, the entire world war may have gone down very differently. We're going to go over an article real quick from The Myth of German Wonder Weapons by Michael Neufeld, who is of the Space History Museum. He's a curator there. And he states in his article that last fall, as I was standing next to the V-2 rocket, the German World War II ballistic missile that's on display at the Space Race Gallery, I heard a man tell his companion how lucky we were that the Nazis had not had it sooner, or that they might have won the war. It is one of the most beloved and entrenched stories, especially in the English-speaking world, about the V-2 and other advanced weapons the Third Reich developed at the end of the war. On the face of it, that assertion makes a lot of sense. The Germans introduced the world's first operational rocket fighter, jet fighter, cruise missile, ballistic missile, man-pad portable missile, recoilless rifle, UFO, helicopters. I mean, they assault rifles. They created so many things out there. The first like tri-engine rockets that could reach across up into the stratosphere. They did it all. And if they had fielded any of these things, to include the Messerschmitt, which is the ME-163 and ME-262 jet fighters, sooner, they could have greatly impeded the daylight strategic bombing of the Allies. Now, the U.S. Army Air Force, their leadership certainly were concerned about this. And if the Nazis had begun firing the V-1 cruise missiles, which the V stands for Vengeance, which is what Joseph Goebbels named them, the Vengeance missiles, if they had started firing the V-1 and V-2 rockets at Berlin earlier, they could have disrupted the D-Day invasion preparations or caused mass panic, derailing the British war economy. Now, key Allied leaders like General Dwight D. Eisenhower and Prime Minister Winston Churchill had discussed those very scenarios. From the Nazi side, the propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels stoked fear with claims beginning in 1943 of the coming Wunderwaffen, the wonder or miracle weapons that would turn the tide and exact vengeance or revenge for the indiscriminate Allied bombing of German cities. After the war, the feeling in the West was that we had experienced a close call, which was reinforced by the memoirs of German ex-generals who blamed Adolf Hitler for holding these weapons up. As a result, the new fighters and missiles allegedly came too late to change the course of the war. Fear of Germany's advanced technology had been a constant since the 1930s. It led directly to the U.S.-British-Canadian Atomic Bomb Project And after German physicists first detected nuclear fission in Berlin in 1933, Hitler himself even made vague threats of these coming super weapons back in 1939, perhaps thinking of the Army's ultra-secret rocket project that would yield the V-2, which was being worked on by then Wernher von Braun, soon to be the father of NASA. When British intelligence detected that program in the spring of 1943, Churchill ordered a special air raid on the Peenemünde Rocket Center on the Baltic. Carried out in August, it was designed to kill the rocket engineers and disrupt the project itself, but was only a partial success. In late 1943 and 1944, the construction of the missile launch and the storage sites that were there in France in the northern part led the Allies to divert the strategic bombers to try to put the sites, direct these bombings to the sites that were out of operation. In spring of 1944, the United States Army Air Force concerns peaked regarding the imminent appearance of German reaction-propelled fighters. The ME-163 rocket interceptor first entered combat in May, zooming through bomber formations at high speed, and in late July, the first ME-262 turbojet aircraft was deployed as well. Yet, there was no crisis. The ME-163 flew so fast that it was challenging to carry out a gunnery run on an American bomber, and it exhausted its propellants within 5 minutes, at which the point the pilot would have to glide back to base. Now, the U.S. fighter pilots soon learned to intercept them during the glide phase or lurk about the landing fields to shoot them down as they were landing, which was feasible because of a growing Allied air superiority. The ME-262 was more effective. It had more conventional flying characteristics and a speed advantage over the piston-driven engine components. But it was also vulnerable to being attacked on landing. In any case, the ME-262's jet engines, being brand new technology, had to be overhauled every few flight hours or they would catastrophically fail. With every launch and then return, the engines had to be replaced. And between the combat appearance of the two fighters, the Luftwaffe also began launching the Fieseler Fi-103 flying bomb, what we would now call a cruise missile. Days after its debut against London on the 13th of June, Joseph Goebbels finally hit upon a propaganda name he liked, the V-1, the Vengeance Weapon 1. It made the biggest impression of any wonder weapon yet. Launched off steam catapults in northeastern France, dozens of V-1s soon began penetrating British airspace day and night, causing a mass exodus of children and families from London. Churchill was so concerned, he tried to talk Allied leaders into dropping poisonous gas canisters on German cities. Yet, that crisis soon passed. By August, the reorganization of the British air defense greatly increased the number of missiles that were shot down at the end of the month. Allied forces overran the Channel coast after the breakout from Normandy. Thereafter, only small numbers of V-1s were launched against the southeast England from Heinkel HE-111 bombers based off in the Netherlands. Hitler ordered a shift in focus to the newly liberated Belgian port of Antwerp, which was needed by the Allies to support its armies and supply them. Army crews first successfully fired the V-2 against Paris and London on September 8th, but Joseph Goebbels held off announcing it for 2 months as the ministry's exaggerated V-1 propaganda had led to a disillusionment inside the Reich. Arriving supersonically, the V-2 could not be shot down with 1944 technology. And its 1 ton of high explosives, when combined with its impact velocity, created a massive crater. It was the most advanced and exotic weapon deployed in World War II, until the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on Japan 11 months later. Yet again, the actual results of the V-2 were a lot less impressive than expected. Like its cruise missile predecessor, it was so inaccurate that it could only be aimed at a large urban area, and many failed during flight or exploded along the countryside. Manufacturing the V-2 cost at least 10 times more than the V-1, and as a result, it was launched in much smaller numbers, about 3,000 missiles, as opposed to the V-1's 22,000 missiles. The very fact that there was no defense against the ballistic missile, other than futile attempts to try to find and bomb the mobile launch crews, meant that the Allies diverted fewer resources to stop it. The Third Reich had earlier deployed the first air-launched anti-shipping missile and the first precision-guided bomb in 1943. And it expended a lot of effort on developing anti-aircraft and air-to-air missiles for home defense, none of which it deployed. The Henschel HX-293, the Fritz X, and the Reinstalker R1, and the Ruhestahl X-4 and other missiles are on display at the Udvar Hazy Center Museum. The net result of these weapons, deployed or otherwise, was that the Reich wasted a lot of money and technical expertise and killed a lot of forced enslaved laborers from concentration camps that were moved over to help with facilitating building these launching platforms, building the missiles, and building the missile-making laboratories, and developing and producing exotic devices that yielded little or no tactical and strategic advantage. Now, as for the one true superweapon of World War II, the atomic bomb, the Germans made only limited progress in nuclear technology. Arguments about the reasons for that failure have raged since 1945, but even if German physicists had created a nuclear reactor and a bomb design, it was very unlikely that the Third Reich could have built the huge isotope separation plants needed, given relentless Allied bombing during the time of the war. So here's a question to you. Did the Wonder Weapons come too late? Quite the opposite. They came too early. Jet engine technology was still too new and temperamental, as were many of the component technologies of the new weapons. The V-1 and V-2 attacks, almost entirely on London and Antwerp, had no strategic result because the missiles lacked accurate guidance systems and nuclear warheads. The British-American conventional four-engine aircraft were far more effective at strategic bombing. In any case, Hitler had lost the war by 1941 when he attacked the Soviet Union and declared war on the United States, with the result that Germany was arrayed against not just one great power, the British Commonwealth, but three. It took until 1942 for the manpower and production imbalance to manifest itself on the battlefield. But thereafter, the Third Reich was bludgeoned into submission by the Allied superiority. So, what we're going to go over next is just a compromised list of what I could find on these weapons. And it is truly fantastical whenever you start to look at all this stuff. We're going to go to our first break. And before we go to that break, please make sure you visit www.AmericanVindictaShow.com. That's our website's finally up. Go to the sponsors page. And if you are in need of emergency food supply, if you are in need of rations, please go to our sponsors, My Patriot Supply. Click on that link. It'll send you there to them. That's how I get credit for whenever you buy anything from them. Now, I'm serious when I say this. If you are a prepper and you do not have 6 months, 8 months, a year's worth of food, you're making a very big mistake. Now, there's a lot of people out there who sell a lot of food, who sell a lot of crap. I am not someone who is a proponent of selling you crap. I'm not going to sell you as seen on TV inventions. I don't believe in any of that. Everything that I buy is expensive. I used it in the military, and I used it during law enforcement, and I still currently have it today. I don't buy cheap clothes. I don't buy cheap boots. I don't buy cheap backpacks. Nothing that I buy is cheap. Overhauled in China, sewn together in Pakistan, I buy as much 100% American made that I can, except for some of my weapons, because some of the German weapons are just really good. Now, all that being said, my Patriot Supply probably makes some of the best tasting food out there. It's very simple to buy. It's very simple to house. It comes in very nice containers, and they can last up to 20 to 25 years. So it's a food insurance that at the end of the day, you can eat it if you need it. Look at all the storms that we've been having knocking out power. If you live in that, you know, godforsaken area of the country where you just have nothing but 6 to 8 feet of snow, the power's out, and you can't exactly go outside, well, at least you would have some form of preserved freeze-dried food that you can then use to eat. Trust me, as a father, I have 4 kids, and even though I live on a small farm, I would still rather try to tap into my food preserves than having to go out and kill my livestock. All these things should be used to enhance the amount of food that you already have on your person at your house. You should be able to use these as food extenders by using copious amounts of rice that hopefully you've been buying along with the meat. Don't listen to me anymore. Go to My Patriot Supply. Get what it is that you think you need for your family. Remember this. You need at least 2,000 to 3,000 calories a day. Now, they're not empty calories. And when it comes to us fighting another world war or a civil war or fighting the aliens or whatever is the next problem that we're going to have in this world, when you don't have food and you're hungry, your ability to fight goes down dramatically. Not just fight an enemy, but fight off any type of infectious diseases or common colds or the allergies that you may get occasionally. Having a good full stomach will help you sleep better, it helps your body heal, and that's the food and fuel that you'll need to continue to resist whatever the problem is that you find yourself in. Visit MyPatriotSupply.com, help support this channel, and we're going to go to a break, and I will be right back.
The time for political correctness is in the rearview mirror. The fact is, the American dollar is on the verge of collapse. It's been abused mightily by those in power. Massive debt, massive inflation have left Americans with few options. Most think they have no choice but to ride it out with their money in the bank. And sadly, they're going to awaken one day and all that money is going to be gone. Do you have an option? The answer is yes. Precious metals. But knowing to go into precious metals is not the same thing as knowing who to go into precious metals with. We have an answer for you. It's called Renaissance Precious Metals. It's owned and operated by the famed Steve Quayle, radio talk show host, world famous, and an expert in precious metals. Been doing the work for 34 years. So whether you're interested in gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, whatever your interest is, wherever you want to land in your escape pod, this is it. Renaissance Precious Metals can be reached at 406-586-4842. Call Steve Quayle at 406-586-4842. You can also visit them online at sqmetals.com. Ladies and gentlemen, don't wait. The collapse is underway. The time to act is now.
Okay, and welcome back to American Vindicta. We are going to get straight into it. We're talking about Nazi wonder weapons, and the way I made this list, it's going to go from kind of the mundane to the more extraordinary. And so far, this is a list of all the known wonder weapons that I could find that I believe are truly worth mentioning from the Nazi war mark, the Nazi war machine, and their arsenal. So starting off, we're going to talk about the Panzerkampfwagen, which was also known as the Mouse. Now, the Mouse was a German World War II super heavy tank that was completed in 1944. It is the heaviest fully enclosed armor fighting vehicle ever built. 5 were ordered, but only 2 hulls and 1 turret were ever completed. And the turret being attached before the testing grounds were captured by advancing Soviet military forces. These two prototypes underwent trials in late 1944, and the complete vehicle was 33 feet long, 12 feet wide, and 12 feet high, weighing 188 metric tons. The Mouse's main armament was the Krupp-designed 128mm gun and a coaxial 75mm gun. The 128mm gun was more powerful enough, was powerful enough to destroy all Allied armor fighting vehicles that were then in service, some at ranges exceeding 3,500 meters. The principal problem in the design of the Mouse was developing an engine and drivetrain, which was powerful enough to adequately propel the tank, yet small enough to fit inside of the tank. The drivetrain was electrical and designed to provide a maximum speed of 12 miles per hour. However, during actual field testing, the maximum speed achieved on hard surfaces was about 8 miles per hour, and a top speed of 14 miles per hour was eventually achieved. The vehicle's weight made it unable to use most bridges. Instead, it was intended to ford a depth of 6 feet of being submerged in water, or being fully submerged up to a depth of 26 feet, and it would use a snorkel to cross over rivers. The Mouse was intended to punch holes through the enemy fortifications in the manner of an immense breakthrough tank, while taking virtually no damage to any components. The next is the Rocket U-Boat. The Rocket U-Boat was a series of military projects that were undertaken by Nazi Germany during the Second World War. The projects, which were undertaken at the Peenemünde Army Research Center, aimed to develop submarine-launched rockets, flying bombs, and missiles. The German Navy did not use submarine-launched rockets or missiles from U-boats against targets at sea or ashore. These projects were never reached for combat readiness before the war ended. From May 31st to June 5th of 1942, a series of underwater launching experiments of solid fuel rockets were carried out using submarine U-511 as a launching platform. The rocket system was first envisioned as a weapon against convoy escorts, but with no effective guidance system, the arrangement was ineffective against any moving targets and could only be used for shore bombardments. Development of this system ended in early 1943 because it decreased the U-boat's seaworthiness, more or less. Plans for the rocket U-boat involved an attack on New York City using newly invented V-2 rockets. The unmanned and unpowered containers with V-2 rockets inside of them were to be towed within range of the target by a conventional U-boat, then set up and launched from its gyro-stabilized platform. With thoughts of hitting targets in the United States and in the United Kingdom, a 100-foot-long container of 500 tons displaced was to be towed behind a submerged U-boat. The evacuation of the Peenemünde Center in February 1945 brought an end to all of these developments. There are no records that these were tested with a rocket launch before Germany's final defeat. It is the forerunner and basis of modern ballistic missile submarines. The idea of launching a V-2 rocket from canisters towed across the Atlantic Ocean by U-boats was a testament to the advanced and futuristic weapons programs that were pursued by the German military, which would eventually become the basis for several modern weapon systems. And after the war, the United States and the Soviet Union continued these projects with the assistance of captured German scientists that were brought over by Operation Paperclip, at least on the American side. The U.S. Navy fired Republic Ford JB-2 flying bombs that were reverse-engineered versions of the German V-1 flying bomb from submarines of the USS Kursk and the USS Carbonero in a series of successful tests between 1947 and 1951. During Operation Sandy, a German V-2 rocket seized by the U.S. Army was launched from the upper deck of the aircraft carrier, the USS Midway, on September 6, 1947. In the Soviet Union, German scientists contributed to the development of the Golem 1, a liquid-fueled rocket based on the V-2 rocket design, and the design was to be launched from a submarine-towed capsule. During World War II, Nazi Germany's Kriegsmarine considered various submarine designs for specialized operations or improving the U-boat performance. Many of these designs did not come to fruition for various reasons, of course. Some were abandoned due to practical considerations. Others, toward the end, had to be abandoned as the yards were overrun by Allied forces. Now, the Type 21 submarines were a class of German diesel-electric, also known as the Elektroboot, submarines. These submarines were designed during the Second World War. 118 were completed, with 4 being combat-ready. During the war, only 2 were put into active service and went on patrols, but these were not used in combat. They were the first submarines designed to operate primarily submerged, rather than spending most of their time as a surface ship that could submerge to brief periods as a means of escaping detection. They incorporated many batteries to increase the time that they could spend submerged, as much as several days if needed, and they only needed to surface to periscope depth of recharging via a snorkel. The design included many general improvements, as well as greater underwater speed and by an improved hull design, and greatly improved diving times, the power-assisted torpedo reloading, and the greatly improved crew accommodations. However, the design was also flawed in many ways, with submarines that were being mechanically unreliable and vulnerable during combative damages. The Type 21 submarines were also rushed into production before design work was completed, and the inexperienced facilities which constructed the boats were unable to meet necessary quality standards. After the war, several navies obtained these Type 21s and operated them for decades in various roles, while large navies introduced new submarine designs based off the Type 21. These include the Soviet Whiskey, the U.S. Tang, the British Purpoise, and the Swedish Hagen class, all based off the Type 21 design to some extent. Now, I have a very carefully well-thought-out hunch about the Type 21 and why we don't know too much about it. Mainly because there were so many built, and close to the end of the war, the Germans were using these submarines to evacuate themselves from Germany and from other places that they were occupying, and to use these types of submarines to escape allies and to go to other places around the world. We know they escaped to Italy, they escaped to Spain, some escaped to Africa, some escaped to South America, many escaped to North America for Operation Paperclip. But these types of submarines, compared to their previous models, were created to be bigger, not really combat ready. They were transport ships. These were primarily used to have more people crammed into their quarters, and then they could also go very, very far, hundreds of miles, before ever having to come up and recharge their batteries. And even when they did that, to avoid anything, they used a snorkel so that they could turn on the diesel engines, which would then cycle the batteries and recharge them. I believe they used these types of submarines to get themselves to places like Antarctica, to get themselves to New Schwabenland, to get themselves to South America, because there are so many different unreported, reported, unverified, verified accounts out there of submarines that were seen of Nazi-like material in Antarctica, around Antarctica, and in and around South America. Now, there was another type of submarine that was also used, and that was the Type 23. And the Type 23 were a small coastal submarine that was designed to operate in shallow waters around the North Sea, the Black Sea, and the Mediterranean Sea, where the larger Type 21 electric boats were at risk during World War I. These Type 23s were so small they could carry only two torpedoes, which had to be loaded externally. As with their far larger sisters, the Type 21 class, they were able to remain submerged almost all the time and were faster than the conventional U-boats. And due to the improved streamlining of their shape, batteries with larger capacity and the snorkel attachment, which allowed the diesel engines to be used while submerged, these Type 21 and 23 U-boats revolutionized post-war submarine design, and nearly 1,000 Type 23 boats were projected towards the closing of World War II, but most of these were either canceled, scrapped incomplete, or only projected. But some were made, and we did not find many of them. All right, tanks. Everybody's favorite, tanks. Let's talk about some of the craziest designs for a tank you've ever heard of in your life. The Land Cruiser, the P-1000, also known as the RAT. The RAT was a design for a 1,000-ton tank to be used by Nazi Germany during World War II, which may have been proposed by Krupp director Edward Grote in June 1942, who had already named it the Land Cruiser. Submitted designs and drawings of the vehicle went under the names of Auftrag and number 30404 and other dissertations, which were presented in December 1942 for inspection. The tank was planned to be 1,000 tons, being far heavier than the Panzer 8 Maus, which is one that we just regionally talked about, the heaviest tank that was ever built that weighed 188 tons. The project gained the approval of Adolf Hitler, who had expressed interest in the development of the tank, but was canceled by the Minister of Armaments, Albert Speer, in early 1943. Now, don't forget, Albert Speer, who was in charge of the Minister of Armaments, was always getting into loggerheads with SS Heinrich Himmler, who wanted to oversee and overtake the Minister of Armaments, and later would actually try to plot to kill Albert Speer in 1944. Now, this tank consisted of a fully tracked chassis carrying one of the surplus main gun turrets left over from the planned refitting of a Scharnhorst-class battleship. It was going to use a battleship main cannon as its turret. To protect this immense economic investment, the hull of the vehicle was to carry armor up to 25 centimeters, which is 9.8 inches thick. And several anti-aircraft guns were going to be installed on the vehicle's engine deck to fend off Allied ground attack aircraft. Hitler became enamored with Grote's concept and ordered Krupp to begin development of it in 1942. And as of December 29, 1942, a few preliminary drawings had been completed by the time the concept had been named the RAT by Hitler himself. These submitted designs went under the titles of OKH Auftrag, and Albert Speer was no reasonable use of the tank. That's what he said. He had real no reasonable use of it, and he canceled the project and the prototype and all the manufacturing involved around it. Now, the Land Cruiser was led to another concept that was called the Land Cruiser 1500 Monster, which was a self-propelled siege gun, which would have been heavier than the RAT. Now, the general idea for such a big tank was summed up by Heinz Gerdern, saying that Hitler's fantasies sometimes shift into the gigantic. Not all historians are convinced that the P-1000 even got as far as the outline of design. Although it is generally accepted that Hitler asked for a feasibility study into a 1,000-ton tank in 1942. There is much doubt around the specifics of the plan to use the 280mm 11-inch wide guns or spare turrets from the battleship Genosau. The turrets alone weighed approximately 750 tons and required a five-story structure to house the associated handling rooms and rotating machinery. So the tank would have stood five stories tall, which is taller than probably most motels and hotels that you would stop at. Such weapons would also require separate magazines and shell rooms, as well as handling machinery for this ammunition, all of which required space and power well beyond the scope of what was possible in a 1,000-ton tracked vehicle. Accordingly, some historians believe the P-1000 rat diagram to be either a hoax or alternatively a speculative engineer's sketch made for personal amusement. Now, the rat's proposed size was just so enormous that it would have weighed 1,000 tons, more than five times the weight of the Panzer VIII. And I'll tell you this much, they wouldn't have been able to move the tank probably at all around almost anything. It would have had, if they had actually put the tank into service and it actually started rolling, it would have had no other option but to roll over trees, roll over ditches, go through buildings because it's not going to go over any type of bridge, and probably just attempt to go over the embankments of a river and then come right out of it. But I don't think it could have. I think if they had actually created it, it would have been so damn big, it just couldn't have been moved. And it couldn't have gone very fast being that big. And I think they said it would have took at least 15 crewmen just to pilot the damn thing and to take care of it. Now, the rat divided the weight, which I guess you would include 300 tons of armament, which is the total weight of the guns themselves was 100 tons. So turret armor would have gained 200 tons. Now, 200 tons of armor and frame and 100 tons of track and automotive components, while remaining weight would have been distributed to miscellaneous features around the vehicle. But, you know, at 115 feet long and having a 128-foot naval gun attached to it, it would have stood at least 36 feet high and probably 46 feet wide. Now, this immense weight was to be distributed across the ground by six 1.5 meter wide, which is almost 4 foot wide, tracks that were 69 feet long, together forming two composite treads with a width of 11 foot 10 inches each. So each track on either side would have been almost 12 feet long, almost 70 feet wide. This would help the stability and the weight distribution, but the vehicle's sheer mass would have destroyed any roads. It would have rendered bridges crossing next to impossible. It was expected that its height and its ground clearance, which would have been about 6.5 feet, would have allowed it to ford most rivers with relative ease, thus eliminating the need for bridge crossings. But at that weight, depending on the mire that it would go over, I think it would just sink straight into the mud. Now, the large size and weight would have rendered the tank more than likely unable to travel, if anything. Though its top intended speed was about 25 miles per hour, its huge size and its visibility would have made it extremely vulnerable to aerial bombardment or artillery fire. And I think it would have been just such a waste to have had a vehicle like that. Now, we're already coming across pretty fast on this, and we've only talked about a couple weapons. We're going to briefly blow through this, and we're going to talk about some aircraft. The Blohm and Voss BV-238, the flying boat. Now, the flying boat would have weighed 100 tons which is 220,000 tons fully loaded. The hull of this huge flying boat would have been able to store about 300 personnel, and it was actually put into service, but it was ended up being sunk while it was out on a lake in Hamburg by the Allies, who didn't even want to recover it. They just drug it out into even further depths, and they just sunk it in deep water. There was another really good plane out there that was called the Folkroken, also known as the Focke-Wulf. Now, the real name that they came up with was the German VTOL aircraft. Now, designed by Heinrich Focke, the VTOL was more or less a box fan that put a pilot in it. And they wanted to use it for reconnaissance. And they said that this was this aircraft, which they called an airfoil aircraft, which used two huge propellers in the center of the aircraft, would have been used mainly for reconnaissance, but it's one of those things that never really got out onto the combat service. They never really created it, but you did see videos of this, more than likely, and some disclosed videos from Area 51 from United States Air Force pilots who were testing these extraordinary crafts. Now, next up, we have the America Bomber. This project was an initiative of the German Ministry of Aviation to obtain a long-range strategic bomber for the Luftwaffe that would have been capable of striking the United States, specifically New York City, from Germany, which is a round trip of 11,600 kilometers or 7,200 miles. This concept was raised as early as 1938, but advanced cognate plans for such a long-range strategic bomber design did not begin to appear before the Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring until 1942. And various proposals were put forward, but these plans were all eventually abandoned as they were too expensive, too reliant on rapidly diminishing material and production capacity, or technically unfeasible due to a current war. And there were probably 20 to 25 different prototypes and examples of the America Bomber, to include multi-stage rockets and all different types of weird aircraft to just gigantic aircraft that were used to deliver troops or bombs to New York City. I don't know what they were going to do when they got there, but that was the plan. Now we have the Erato AR-234 Blitz, also known as the Lightning. This was the world's first operational jet-powered bomber built by the German Erato company during World War II. It produced limited numbers and was used mostly entirely for aerial reconnaissance. In its few uses as a bomber, it proved to be nearly impossible to intercept, and it was the last Luftwaffe aircraft to fly over the UK during the war in April 1945. Now we also have the Messerschmitt, the ME-163 Comet. This is a German interceptor aircraft designed for point defense. It is the only operational rocket-powered fighter aircraft in history and the first piloted aircraft of any type to exceed 621 miles per hour in level flight. It was designed by Alexander Lipich, and its performance in aspects of design were unprecedented. Eventually, the German test pilot Heini Dittmer reached 700 miles per hour in an unofficial flight airspeed record in 1944. The Germans were highly advanced compared to anybody else. Then you had the Messerschmitt ME-262, named the Swallow. Now, it was a fighter-bomber version of the previous version, and it was the world's first operational jet-powered fighter aircraft. The ME-262 was faster and more heavily armed than any Allied fighter, including the British jet-powered Gloster Meteor, and one of the most advanced aviation designs in operational use during World War II. The ME-262's roles included light bomber, reconnaissance, and experimental fighter versions. ME-262 pilots claimed a total of 542 Allied aircraft shot down, although higher claims are sometimes made. Then we have the German Silverbird, the Silbervogel. This was a design for a liquid propellant rocket-powered suborbital bomber that was produced by Eugene Sanger. Now, in the late 1930s, the Third Reich they really started to go down this path of very fanciful aircraft. And this aircraft is also known as the RABO, the Rakenbomber, or rocket bomber, was one of a number of designs considered for the America Bomber mission, which started in the spring of 1942. But they had all different types of strategic bombers that were out there. But this plane was intended to be a space plane. When Walter Dornberger attempted to create interest in military space planes in the United States after World War II, he chose the more diplomatic term, the Antipopal Bomber, and he based it off the Silverbird. The design was a significant one as it incorporated new rocket technology and the principle of a lifting body, foreshadowing future development of winged spacecraft such as the X-20 Dinosaur of the 1960s and the Space Shuttle that was used in the 1970s. The Space Shuttle from the 1970s was developed more or less in 1944 and in the beginning to that from the 30s from the Nazis. That's how far advanced these people were. The Fritz X. This was the most common name for a German-guided anti-ship glide bomb used during World War II. The Fritz X was the world's first precision-guided weapon deployed in combat and the first to sink a ship in combat. So that ends the rockets and the spacecraft. And we're at 48 minutes, and I'm telling you, I'm only like 4 pages left of this. So we're going to get into this real quick. The Karl Gerät, we're going to talk about artillery guns. The Karl Gerät was probably the biggest self-propelled siege mortar design built in the world at that time. It's the heaviest munition that was used during that time. They were 24 inches in diameter and about 4 feet tall. So think of a 50-gallon drum. And the shell itself weighed 4,780 pounds. And 7 guns were built, 6 of which saw combat between 1941 and 45. It was used in attacking the Soviet fortresses of Brest-Litovsk and Sevastopol. It bombarded Polish resistance fighters in Warsaw, participated in the Battle of the Bulge, and was used to try to destroy the Ludendorff Bridge during the Battle of Remagen. One Karl Gerät has survived, and the remainder were all scrapped during the war. Now, the seven had various names. The first 6 had the nicknames Adam, which was later changed to Balder, Eva, which was later changed to Wotan, Thor, Odin, Loki, and Zoe. The 7th, the research and test weapon, had no name. Delivery of the 6 production vehicles took place from November 1940 to August 1941. Now, these shells were gigantic, and the problem with these shells was they were used for bunker busting. They were used for very heavy bunker busting. One of them actually penetrated 94 meters down to hit a bunker. The most common problem with them was that they were such big shells that regular housing and hotels and, you know, industrial buildings that were used that they were bombing for these areas were so soft in their material that they actually wouldn't make the explosive warhead ignite. So the shells would just cannonball through everything and eventually would find themselves stuck somewhere underneath a basement's basement. I mean, these shells were just gigantic. Firing trials for the 54-centimeter shells were not completed until the end of 1944, and they were not used in combat before then. And the original 60-centimeter shells, the heavy shell, had no other designation or name except for the heavy concrete piercing shell, which were about 4,780 pounds. There was an even bigger gun called the Schwer-Gustav, which was the same type of rail gun, but it was a railway-towed gun, And it's all different types of action in Operation Barbarossa, Battle of Sevastopol. It helped with the French capitulation. It was going to be used on the Maginot Line and the Battle of France. But Gustav was destroyed by the Germans near the end of the war in 1945 to avoid the Soviet Red Army, who was collapsing in on them. So we're going to talk about the A4 and V2. And we're going to have to go to a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum has said, "You will own nothing, and you will love it." And that's represented by what's going on across the planet today, where the economy of the world is in free fall, and nowhere is it more in evidence than with our own President Biden deliberately trying to sabotage what we have. Access to food, other resources. So Americans are in a unique position, really for the first time in our history. We're going to have to provide for ourselves or subject ourselves to the whim of the government. Do you really trust a government to feed you that left 1,000 Americans behind enemy lines in Afghanistan? I don't think so. So where do you go? When you ask the question, who's the best prepper out there today? There's only one answer. Ready Made Resources and Robert Griswold. I call him King Prepper, and that's how a lot of people think of him. You have everything there you'd want, from night vision to storable food, how to prepare cooking in emergency situations, books and videos on how to prepare alternative energy, communication, first aid that you wouldn't think of, natural antibiotics, you name it. Bob has it. Now, here's the good thing about Bob Griswold that no one else does but him. You don't have to buy anything to talk to him. If you're not sure where to start with your preparation, no obligation phone call directly to Bob. You can talk to him for free. Most people will charge you an arm and a leg for a half-hour conversation. That's not Bob Griswold. He cares about helping America get prepared. Go to readymaderesources.com or you can call the number directly at 800-627-3809. Again, that contact information, readymaderesources.com for the best prepping outfit in the country, or call Bob Griswold directly, 800-627-3809.
Okay, welcome back to American Vindicta. I'm telling you, I'm running out of time. There's just too much to try and cover with these wonder weapons of Nazi Germany. But the V2 rocket is the original predecessor for the three-stage rocket. Now, it was proposed to use an advanced version of the A9 and A10 to target parts of the U.S. mainland. And the A9 would be the middle gateway in between the A-10, which when this rocket launched, it was to go into the stratosphere and then come back down upon a city, obviously New York City as usual. But it was the first three-stage rocket, one of these things that helped us get to the moon, that helped us get into space, and was, as usual, in help of development by Wernher von Braun. The A-12, they also had the A-11 and the A-12. And the A-12 design was a true orbital rocket. It was proposed as a four-stage vehicle comprising of the A-12, the A-11, A-10, and A-9 stages. Each A was a different stage of the rocket. And these calculations suggested it could place as much as 10 tons of payload in low Earth orbit, which was roughly as much as the first iteration of the Falcon 9 rocket. The A-12 stage itself would have weighed about 3,500 tons, fully fueled. These were once again the rockets that helped us within NASA to get to space to then get our astronauts to the moon. Okay, that's the stuff they came up with in the 40s. And we didn't get into the moon until when? So, Operation Paperclip, that's how America got so far with their rocket technology. Now, there are some other really crazy things out there, like the space-based weapons. In 1929, the German physicist Hermann Oberth developed plans for a space station from which a 100-meter-wide concave mirror would be used to reflect the sun onto a concentrated point of Earth, which he said could boil oceans and burn cities. Late during World War II, a group of German scientists at the German Army Artillery Proving Grounds in Heisselbergen began to expand upon Oberth's idea of creating this super weapon by harnessing the sun. With the development and validation of satellite mega constellations, their use of this sun gun has also been proposed. And instead, a vast individual mirror and hundreds of low-cost reflectors could, in theory, be synchronized to concentrate solar irradiance and aim it as a target. The Germans claimed that the sun gun could be completed within 50 to 100 years. 50 to 100 years. That's what they told Allied forces, which were U.S. Army officers who had caught them, and they admitted this to them. So, real quick before we have to go, Nazi Germany helped create the first assault rifle, the thing that scares Congress more than anything else, which was the STG-44. Do that on investigation of your own. But we didn't really get to get into Nazi UFOs. So before we close and we go into this, tomorrow we are going to be having Steve Quell on. He's going to be telling us about his book, Empire Under the Ice, and he's going to unload a lot about Nazi UFOs, which is why the whole buildup of this has happened the way I did it today. Now, Nazi UFOs, we also were heard, you know, being called the Foo Fighters. And there was all different types of speculations out there and stories and investigations that were being done by the U.S., by the Allied Army, by the Axis Army, also had plenty of eyewitnesses about them. And you really have to do your own research into this just to get the depth of UFOs that were seen by both the Axis and Allied personnel. And it's truly interesting. It makes for a great read. It's a good way to close the night. Do your own investigation. I've probably spent the last 6 hours looking up stuff to only talk to you for about 45 minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Doug Thornton. This is American Vindicta. Thank you for listening. Please join us tomorrow for our sit down with Steve Quell and spread the message of this channel. We're trying to bring as much history to you as possible. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening. We're out.
All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.